Third Coast Digest is brought to you in part by 91.7 FM, WMSE Frontier Radio.
Jillian, Roger, welcome. You are a professor of musicology and ethnomusicology at UWM, and I wanted to talk to you today. Somebody sent me an article about lyrics in popular music, Lady Gaga, Rihanna, Keisha, Lil' Kim, things like that. I'll read a couple of these lyrics because they kind of astounded me and made me feel either like an old fogey or made me feel even sadder about the way the mainstream culture is heading. Here's one. No, okay, Rihanna's the best one. The song is called S&M. Come on, come on, come on. I like it. I like it. Come on, come on, come on. I like it. SSS and MMM, SSS. Oh, I love the feeling you bring to me. Oh, you turn me on. It's exactly what I've been yearning for. Give it to me strong and meet me in my boudoir. Make my body say, ah, ah, ah. I like it, because I may be bad, but I'm perfectly good at it. Sex in the air, I don't care. I love the smell of it. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but chains and whips excite me. So it seemed to me that this is a level of well, the language is actually is obviously painting a picture of a woman who likes to be or wants to be asked to be used, beaten, manipulated by a man in a violent way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm overreacting to that.
I think in some ways what you're doing is looking at the lyrics and reacting immediately to the lyrics. If you go to YouTube and you look at the video,
right,
it takes on a whole different meaning. First of all, one of the things that you see in this video is, I mean, apart from the use of fetish objects, so there's lots of ball gags, there's lots of duct tape, there's lots of rubber suits, but the set of characters that feature the most in this particular video are the press.
The press, ah.
And they're rather stereotypical press figures with the microphones, with the cameras,
right,
with the notepads. And as far as I can tell, this is not necessarily really sophisticated commentary, but commentary on the kind of tabloid culture that she is part of. Because by the end of the video, those same figures have morphed into clowns with the Afro wigs, with the large suit shoes.
Right.
And that it becomes the kind of scandal-driven tabloid, what am I going to read I've been involved in next? And she does the entire thing with a sort of a wink and a nudge and a sort of a camp sensibility that the whole video can't be taken seriously. And that's one of the problems with these songs is that if you take just the lyrics,
right,
without the production, without the video, which is so central.
Without the theater of it.
Without the theater of it. And in fact, what's interesting about this song, and I looked at this because I've actually worked on a song from the 1980s that was very much used S&M. And it was much more violent than this in a lot of ways.
What was the song?
It was from the Eurythmics. It was
okay.
I Need You. It talks about torment. It talks about back-breaking. And then the last line of that verse is, I need you to listen to the ecstasy I'm faking. I need you. And it's just that word. It's that twist at the last line.
Just the I'm faking.
That I'm faking that throws everything else into doubt. And it took me something like 20 years to work out that song. And I'm not sure I fully worked it out, but the layers of meaning that emerge from it in terms of the relationship between the performer and their audience and the sadomasochistic relationship between performer and audience, the relationship between men and women,
mm-hmm,
and that what she's doing is taking a male position. The male position in classic sadomasochism is to be the victim. And she is taking the victim role and then refusing to play, which is also a sort of exaggerated feminine role.
Right.
And so what I did was read it against feminist scholarship, against conservative Christian marriage counseling, against biblical verses, against 1940s psychoanalysis, and the way that male-female relationships still exist in the popular are often caught up in some of these relationships. With the power inequities.
Right.
And so it becomes a really eloquent commentary on the kinds of traps that people find themselves in.
All right. So it is, because it worried me seeing it, and I couldn't tell whether they were falling victim to something that's been going on for a long
time. Well, it depends on the song, and it depends on the artist, and that's the thing that gets really difficult.
It is difficult, and I suspect that the main audience for most of these songs is young women, I suspect, 12 to 20?
Yeah, I think that all of these artists are very popular with young women.
Right.
As far as I can tell, I mean, and I looked at a number of Rihanna's videos. The one that I found actually much more disturbing was Rude Boy, which is a very simple, let's wag our butts, let's, you know, give it to me hard, give it to me.
Right.
But what's interesting about the way that the narrative emerges from that is she says, I will let you. And it's the way that these women construct their sexuality through song that posit they're in charge of the experience. The singer depicts themselves as being in charge. Young women read this as a powerful thing.
Right.
Now, of course, older women go, whoa, hang on.
Right.
Because we recognize there's still power differentials out there in the world, and young people, I still find, you know, people in their mid-20s suddenly realize things aren't equal.
Right.
And then they get furious and angry and blame me for not doing enough work.
Because you didn't fix it for them.
Because it's not 100% perfect.
Right. Right.
And I have to remind them of, you know, I usually say given minimum 2,000 years documented history of women's oppression, let's see what you don't have to do. But they don't, you know, it's when they get outraged, as I got outraged, although I don't believe I blamed my mother's generation for not fixing it.
Right.
And I think that's changed in the last 20 to 30 years.
So just to follow that through a little bit, so their perception, I mean, they still are putting themselves in a position of being a victim.
In some ways, they put themselves in a position where they can easily become a victim, and then they're angry when
right.
they are victimized.
When they're victimized.
But I think that because they're also told that to be fully a woman, you have to be attractive to men.
Well, that's the skew in the culture that I don't know when we'll ever get over, because women are still asked, they're asked to be independent, they're asked to be mothers, they're asked to work, they're asked to be sexually in charge of their own bodies, and they're also asked to be pleasing to men.
Yeah.
Wear high heels, put on makeup, do all that.
And they still suffer from that old hypocrisy that if they give it up too easily, they're a slut, they're a whore, and men are just being virile. This is, I always ask my students to consider, what is the male equivalent to a nymphomaniac?
A stud.
Right. Well, right. It's a positive thing.
Yeah,
although what I find is interesting is in some of these videos, particularly Rihanna, what's interesting is in Rihanna's video Unfaithful, and this is a relatively early one. It's from 2006. It's a very melodramatic song in which she's sort of suffering angst over what she puts her boyfriend through. But what's interesting is she's the unfaithful one. She's the one who is cheating on him, and she says, I'm killing him a little at a time. So that she's not a slut. She's not suffering stigma for cheating on him, but she's suffering guilt, which I find is an interesting twist on an old theme. Although in all of these cases, I can think of examples from the 1970s, the 1980s that do exactly the same thing.
Well, it's not uncommon that sex and violence are linked closely.
Well, it's true, but I mean, this unfaithful narrative, the song that I thought of was from Joan Armatrading, who's an English performer, and basically it's a narrative of someone cheating on someone they love and loving people at once, and the guilt of that. But the thing with Joan Armatrading is that she's got an extremely low voice, and she's always read ambiguously. She's often read as a lesbian. There's no sort of discussion about whether she is or she isn't.
Right.
It's completely ambiguous, but she's long been known as a feminist performer, partly because of the generation she's in, partly because of the kinds of songs she sings, so that it can be very easily read. Some of my students read her as a man suffering about, you know, cheating on her lovers. Some others read her as a woman, but that the lover is also female.
Right.
And what's interesting with Rihanna is she's taking that, and it's very clear that the lover is male.
Right, okay.
So that it takes a new twist on that.
Right.
Yeah, so some of the, I mean, the themes have been around for at least the last 30 years.
Well, and probably longer than that. But what concerns me, and not necessarily about right now, but concerns me about it, is that in popular culture, these artists may have an ironic understanding of it, or the artist's distance on it, but it still appears to the 12, 14, 16-year-olds, I wonder if it appears, that they're celebrating this kind of behavior.
Well, what's interesting is that there have been studies, less so in the United States, but certainly in England, where pop culture researchers have talked with groups of young girls.
Right.
And they have a curiously 1950s sort of moral attitude towards some of this. That, in other words, they understand themselves needing to be sexual. They also understand the pitfalls of sexuality. They understand about unintended pregnancy.
Pregnancy, right.
They are often quite judgmental.
Do people still worry about disease?
I'm not so sure that that's on their radar anymore, because things like AIDS have turned into a manageable long-term disease. It's no longer a death sentence in the way that it was in the 1980s.
In the 80s, no, because that's what I remember.
Right, exactly. I mean, most of these kids haven't lost friends.
Right.
And the experience of those of us who lived through the 80s, who sometimes lost most of our friends, is just completely foreign to them.
Right.
But what's interesting is that these young kids understand that they can be sometimes quite judgmental about the people they're looking, and they like people and don't like people on whether they think that they're a slut or not. So that, you know, Britney was celebrated for a while, and then they turned on Britney because they saw her as being too loose, too easy.
She walked the line,
right,
but she fell off of it.
And then, of course, one of the things about
pushed
a number of these, I'm thinking particularly Rihanna, I'm thinking Katy Perry, who is so close to aging out at this point, is that once they hit 30, it's over.
Right.
It's really hard for these young women to sustain a career past 30, because most of them are playing somewhere between 15 and 25.
Right. Right.
And
that's certainly their audience. Right.
Right. And you get to be too mature.
Right.
Now, the challenge for pop singers from time immemorial is, how do we stay active past 25?
Right.
And very few women do.
Right.
And the ones who do tend to develop a niche market, which is why Lady Gaga, I think, may have some more staying power.
Mm.
First of all, she is not aiming at the tween market. She is aiming at gay boys.
Okay.
Her market is gay men. She does dance music for the clubs. It's what we fondly know as butt-to-nut music.
So that's what Bette Midler did at the beginning of her career.
It's what Madonna did.
And Madonna did,
and
too.
In fact, Madonna is very much an influence on Lady Gaga.
You can see that.
She cites Madonna, but she also cites Freddie Mercury. She cites David Bowie for the theatricality.
Yeah, sure.
What I find really interesting, and I haven't seen her cite him, but I see Marilyn Manson in her. Because what she does is she takes high fashion and beauty across into grotesque.
Yeah.
And she makes grotesqueness beautiful. And it seems to me that there's a role for a disability fetish in some of her work, sex fetish, but not like the act of sex, but rather that sort of sexualizing and fetishizing things that you don't expect to be fetishized.
Right.
So that, you know, those shoes, I don't know if you've seen those high heel shoes that she walks on where you're literally on your toes. She walks on those better than models.
Right.
It's that sort of extreme discomfort that verges on drag.
Right.
Is she even a female?
Right. But she's so blatantly female, but then there's still,
she's a construction of female.
Right.
But is this who she is?
Right.
Is she biologically female? Probably, but she's more a drag queen than anything else.
Right. Certainly the presentation is more that. That's the thing I wonder about her, that, I mean, she seems to be in one way a really sort of a wonderful artist,
mm-hmm.
in that she's constructed this personality, persona, this show, exactly the way you described it. There's an androgyny there, but it isn't what I remember as androgyny. David Bowie also.
Yeah,
was he female?
Well, and Freddie Mercury is a really good, I think the fact that she looks to Freddie Mercury is really interesting, because Freddie Mercury was influenced by everything from show tunes to Bollywood musicals.
Right.
So it's a much broader palette than merely pop. Lady Gaga went to the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU. So she has a sophisticated music background. She's also more active as a composer than, as far as I can tell, Rihanna or Katy Perry are. The other person that you named, who I find actually quite fascinating, is Kesha, because she is a young woman who's from the industry. There was an interview with her on NPR when she first appeared on the scene, and her mother works in the music industry, and Kesha is completely mercenary about what she is doing.
Mm.
There's no illusion about what she is doing.
That's why the dollar sign in her name.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
She understands that she's there to make some money. She's there for the short term. This is not a lifetime for her.
Right.
And she also writes her own music. she knows how to write a song with an amazingly good hook.
Right.
So that you find yourself being drawn to it even as you hate yourself for being drawn to it.
Right.
And it puts her in a different class of performer to me.
That makes her, rather than just a pawn of the music industry, it makes her an artist.
Well,
in a way,
she could still be a pawn of the music industry. I mean, it's very difficult now. Commercial forces are in all of this.
Right. Many of these songs, it seems, are written by men, and the companies that produce them are controlled by men.
Well, the companies are certainly controlled by men. Songs are usually written by a team. The singer often gets credit, but usually it's nominal credit, which is no different than the 1920s, where almost every single vaudevillian who sang a song got the credit for the lyrics, whether they wrote them or not.
Right.
It enabled them to get a financial cut. And that's, I mean, Madonna gets credit for the songs that she sings. I've seen some stuff about the production process, and she certainly has some input, but Madonna is as a corporate entity as much as she is an individual.
Right.
And that's true for any of these young women. A number of them actually take quite an active role.
Right.
Very few of them are merely pawns anymore. I think that the industry is complicated enough that if you're going to last more than one hit, you can't merely be a pawn. You're complicit in your own construction.
Well, certainly the presentation is of an empowered woman, a woman who is speaking from her soul about what it is to be a woman in a way.
Yeah, which in some ways is reflecting second wave feminism. I mean, you know, this is a popular interpretation of second wave feminism. These young women now, I think in some ways they imagine they're equal, and yet they don't quite know how to make their way in the world. And so that they want these role models, and they don't tend to think of most often, as far as I can tell from my students, they often don't think of their mothers as being it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're doing the old teenage boy thing of rebelling against their parents,
sure,
which means that their parents must automatically be anti-sex. They've heard that the personal is political, so I get a belly button piercing, I'm being political, to which I often respond to them, no, the personal is political, but not everything personal is political.
Right.
Sometimes it's just a belly button piercing.
Right.
So that they're negotiating between these roles. And they still really do feel the pressure to be good girls.
Do they?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Partly because bad girls, I mean, they don't want to be sluts, they don't want to be whores.
Right.
And, I mean, we saw the...
So they still think that bad girls suffer?
Well, they suffer particularly through social stigma.
Right, okay.
Because there is nothing more brutal than middle school and high school girls.
Right. Yeah.
They shun each other, and they shun each other with a sort of violence. And I don't mean physical violence, but I mean you can completely destroy someone's social life. You can harass them online. You can, you know, there's so many more avenues for meanness now.
Right, right. And that's the stereotype, is that those middle school girls are master manipulators.
Absolutely.
And viciously, mentally, psychologically vicious.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a stereotype based in part on observed behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not that simple. None of this is that simple.
Right.
But there is some reality there that they fear being shunned, because they're deeply social and they want to belong.
Right. One thing I want to go back to, just to clear up and round off, as it were, when we talked about Rihanna, when we talked about Kesha, when we talked about Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, there's a thing that Gloria Steinem said: we've become the men that we were warned about. In terms of charting feminism as it has evolved and continues to evolve, you talk about second wave feminism. Are they, in order to survive and function in the world, are these women having to function and having to think of themselves as men?
Well, we're in a really interesting period right now where gender is clearly changing, but it's not clear what it's going to become.
Right.
And what there's been concern recently, because the vast majority of people finishing high school are female, the vast majority of people graduating college are female.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've seen it staged in sort of frighteningly eugenic terms in, you know, well, these women won't have anyone to marry if there's no educated men, you know, as though a woman with a bachelor's degree can't marry a laborer and be extremely happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the class,
right,
you know, die-off,
yeah,
nonsense. But on the other hand, I'm now finding that the way women are behaving as undergrads is much closer to the way young men did 10 years ago. In other words, they're starting to think that they should succeed because they've always succeeded.
Uh-huh.
And the boys who are in the class are now often working harder. And they're much more engaged than the girls, which I never thought I would live to see. But of course, what we're missing is all the boys who maybe would have gone to college 10 or 15 years ago and are now withdrawing because they do not want to compete as equals with the girls.
Right.
Because to be educated is to be female.
Uh-huh.
So it's an interesting kind of twist that's coming. So I think that if we say male and female, what we might be talking about is mid-20th century. We're not talking early to mid-21st century. We're not clear what that is now, which might be why there's so much anxiety because, you know, if you don't know what you're supposed to be, and unfortunately young women now think they're supposed to do everything.
Right, sure.
And that on one hand, lets men off the hook. On the other hand, it stops them from being full people.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it may let them off the hook and they can just go and have fun, but it also maybe takes some notion of pride away from
exactly.
them.
Exactly. I mean, I subscribe to a very old-fashioned feminism, which is the radical notion that women are people too. But then, of course, now men need also to be people, which is to be fully people, which is to be allowed to have an emotional life beyond anger and violence, which is allowed to have interests beyond football and big screen televisions, and to be able to have places where they carve out their own space because they need their own space, because now public life has almost flipped to the opposite of 19th century, where it was an entirely male space in the 19th century and women who were in it were prostitutes and able to be used. Now it's so integrated that men, I mean, do we need private space for men?
Right.
And I'm not so sure. I don't know. Because, of course, at the top of corporations, there are still old, powerful men, but young men, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what their future is. And so, you know, I would like us all to be able to live to be as fully human as we all can be, and gender is part of it, but it doesn't limit us.
Right. That would be a wished for world.
I'm a utopian.
Jillian, thank you for coming in. Thank you for talking.
Yeah.